Tune Review and Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 20th of October 2023, from the news section. Climate campaigners lose legal challenge over oil and gas licences. This article is written by Hamish Morrison. Environmental campaigners have lost a High Court challenge over government plans to issue new licences for oil and gas extraction in the North Sea. Greenpeace brought legal action after ministers opened a new round of oil and gas licensing for the seabed off the north and east coast of Britain last October. Greenpeace and Uplift, another campaign body, argued that the Department of Energy, Security and Net Zero began the licensing round without considering the greenhouse gas emissions that would result from burning the fossil fuels. However, ministers said the new oil and gas licensing round is aimed at bolstering the UK's current energy supply, as well as the future security, as the ongoing war in Ukraine sees European nations struggle with high fuel costs. In a ruling on Thursday, Justice Holgate dismissed the claims from the two groups. Representing Uplift at the hearing in July, Estelle Dehon, KC, said in written submissions that ministers had failed to assess reasonable alternatives to new homegrown fossil fuels. However, Justice Holgate said, the Secretary of State had regard to differences in functions and physical characteristics between oil production from a well and subsequent refining, distribution, and the range of end uses, along with spatial and temporal differences. The judge added, there was no internal inconsistency between the approach taken by the Secretary of State to whether end-use emissions should be assessed as a likely significant effect of the plan. Greenpeace said it intends to appeal against the ruling, with Uplift Executive Director Tessa Khan calling the judgment a deeply disappointing decision. Philip Evans, Greenpeace UK's climate campaigner, said, if you told most people that the government is allowed to approve new oil and gas while ignoring 80% of the emissions it would produce, they simply wouldn't believe you. This is completely irresponsible behaviour from ministers during a climate crisis. That's why we will be appealing and hope this ruling will be overturned. More oil and gas drilling will just make oil giants richer and the climate crisis worse. Instead, we urgently need to move to abundant, cheap, clean, renewable power and prioritise insulating homes. This is the only way to tackle the cost of living, guarantee our energy security and ensure a safer climate. That article was written by Hamish Morrison. This is from The National on Friday the 20th of October 2023, from the comments section. I was on BBC Scotland's debate night. This is what it was like. This article is written by Professor Richard Murphy. As some readers will know, I was on BBC Scotland's debate night programme last night. The experience was interesting. There were stressed politicians swatting their notes before going on air. The usual fuss of television increased their stress before we went in front of the audience, who I thought were pretty good. And then the hour on air rushes by with too little opportunity to get in all the points you want to make. We addressed four questions during the programme. I will elaborate on just one here. It was almost inevitable that there would be a question following on from the SNP conference, and it duly appeared. More precisely, we were asked whether the SNP's policy on a new mandate for independence was appropriate. I was candid. When there are politicians around making claims that are more akin to wishful thinking, I always think it an advantage to be so. The audience certainly seemed to share that view. So, I began by saying that the reality is that whatever the SNP might say, neither the Tories or Labour are going to agree to independence for Scotland at any time soon. The reason, I suggested, is that neither party wants to abandon its colonial interest in Scotland any time soon, or in Wales or Northern Ireland, come to that. There was a gasp or two in response from the audience at the apparent audacity of my comment. This, though, was overwhelmed by applause. I seemed to strike a chord. That, however, as I explained, provides the SNP with an opportunity. What it has to do now is stop arguing about the process of securing independence and go back to what it once had to do, which is to explain why it should secure independence. In my opinion, nothing is more important. Crucial to this argument is, however, the need for the SNP to now address three issues. The first is the fact that the existing devolution settlement does not work, cannot work, and was even designed not to work by those parties that now want to make sure that Scotland cannot move on from it. Nowhere is this more apparent than on economic issues. The freedom to tax that Scotland has is very limited and is, if anything, deeply harmful to the cause of creating a fair tax system in the country. You cannot achieve that when Scotland is denied the chance to alter any tax on capital gains, inheritance, investment and savings income, companies and national insurance. As a result, Scotland does not also have the freedom to spend what is needed. I suspect that few in Scotland really understand this. Second, Scotland is hampered by the fact that the UK has left the EU, and despite the glaringly obvious need to admit that this has been a disastrous mistake, neither Labour or the Tories will do this, let alone do anything about it. Scotland does, as a result, urgently require the opportunity to reset its own relationship with the world, which is currently denied it. Third, there is the issue of democracy. Sue Webber, MSP for the Tories, tied herself in all sorts of knots during the programme by complaining at what she suggested was the anti-democratic position of the SNP in assuming that securing a majority of seats in a Westminster election, even if that meant a minority of the electorate might have voted for them, might deliver a claim to an election victory and a mandate for action. Given that this is exactly how Westminster works, there was a rightful cynicism about that claim by her. What it did, however, highlight is the fact that the SNP have to make clear that Scotland will need to be a proper democracy after independence, based on proportional representation and with a wide range of parties, some of whom might then deny the SNP power. The problems that many people have of thinking that if they support independence, they might face SNP government forever, has to be addressed, because this need not be the case. That, however, requires a degree of honesty from the SNP that many politicians, once they've got used to the trappings of ministerial office, find hard to offer. The truth about the Union. As I made clear during the programme, I think Scotland is being held back by the fact that it is in the Union. Well-being in this country is being harmed by rule of Westminster. The SNP have long been the torchbearers for independence. They might need to be so again, working alongside a more independently minded Yes movement. But, and this is vital, that requires that the SNP be honest about the limitations on what they can do now, what the conditions for successful independence are, including having a Scottish currency, and what their own role in Scottish politics might be, if independence is won, because that might well be very different from what it is at present. The question is, are the SNP up to that? Independence might require that they are. That article was written by Professor Richard Murphy. This is from The National, on Friday the 20th of October 2023, from the Culture section. Cost of living crisis. Glasgow cafe closes after 13 years. This article is written by Marissa McWhirter. A much-loved cafe has been forced to close due to the cost of living crisis, inspiring a member of staff to launch a desperate bid to reopen it. Rose and Grants, known especially for its vegan offering, operated on Trongate in the city centre for 13 years, before closing its doors last Friday. Some of the cafe's 15 members of staff had to find a new job overnight, while others have said they are going to wait it out, says General Manager Heather Moore. Now, the knock-on impact of lockdown restrictions, the quadrupling of energy bills, food inflation hitting 20%, and essential wage rises have made continuing impossible, said previous owner Ben Rose. He added, these costs appear to have levelled off, and the past 3 months have actually been the highest sales and profits ever. Rose and Grants is a more than viable cafe. But I can't keep going. After 13 years, it's taken a toll on my mental health. The Glasgow Times spoke to owner Ben in January, who told of how the cafe's energy bills had shot up to £4,300 per month. Heather, who has been working at the cafe since June, told the Glasgow Times she found out about the impending closure just 2 weeks ago. The 34-year-old said, the cafe had had its best sales day ever, and then, the next day, I found out something was quite wrong. It's been really hard because it doesn't make sense. It's a busy cafe. She added, it closed last Friday, and as far as I knew, I was working on Saturday. I came in instead to meet up with staff and organise wages and start to write a sign to let customers know on the window. Heather, who has worked in hospitality on and off for nearly 15 years, has made it her mission to reopen the cafe. Setting a fundraising target of £15,000, she hopes to bring Rose and Grants back to life with donations from the public. Rather than take out a business loan, Heather said, I thought that the most appropriate way to do it is this way. She added, what I've seen in the last few months and the fact that it was there for 13 years makes me confident that this will work. And I have felt more confident about what I've learned in the last few years that I can actually put it towards a loved cafe. Ben describes Heather as gutsy and confident. He said, I want to see the cafe go from strength to strength under new leadership. He added, Rose and Grants has always been staff-led, so they understand the costs, the reality and the challenges. Unlike most places, the team under Heather will also know how to make it work. I have helped Heather get started with a new company and will support her and the team to get things moving again. Heather says if the crowdfunder is not successful, she will look into other options. She said, to be honest, I feel a bit shell-shocked right now and I'm just getting my head around what's happened. The fundraiser has raised £2,585 at the time of writing and closes on November the 12th. The £15,000 will go towards buying back the cafe's assets, as well as start-up costs like buying produce and rehiring staff members. Donations do not result in shares of the business, and if the target is not met, donors will be reimbursed. Heather said, Rose and Grants is important. If you have a spare £20, it really does make a difference, and so we appreciate it. That article was written by Marissa McWhirter. This is from The National, on Friday the 20th of October 2023, from the news section. Storm Babette. body found as woman swept into river in Angus. This article is written by James Walker. The body of a 57-year-old woman has been recovered from a river in Angus, where a red weather alert is currently in force, Police Scotland said. Officers were called to the Water of Lee at Glen Esk at about 13:45, and the body was found at 1600. A spokesperson added, "There are no suspicious circumstances surrounding the death, and a report will be submitted to the Procurator Fiscal." First Minister Humza Yousaf sent his condolences to her family. He said, "Such sad news. My thoughts are with the family, friends and loved ones of the woman who has sadly lost her life. People living in areas hit by red weather warnings are being urged not to travel amid the very serious situation." The Met Office has extended the weather warning, which is in place from 6 p.m. Thursday, from the initial warning area to cover the area north of Perth and Aberfeldy. It now stretches from southern Aberdeenshire and Angus to the outskirts of Dundee and Perth. Other parts of Scotland are affected by yellow and amber warnings. On Thursday evening, as hundreds of people were evacuated due to flood fears in Brecon, Yousaf said the government had completed a resilience meeting about the situation. "We urge people to listen to the advice, particularly in the red warning area, urging people not to travel. It is for your own safety," he wrote. "We, alongside local partners, are focused on people's welfare. We continue to monitor the situation closely. There will be severe disruption in some parts of the country, so please listen to the advice and stay safe." And speaking to BBC Scotland, Deputy First Minister Shona Robertson said the situation is very serious, as red warnings are not often issued. "People should check in with Police Scotland or Transport Scotland to make sure they know whether their area is covered," she urged. "People should absolutely not travel in those areas." She also warned that Storm Babette could hit more parts of Scotland in the coming days. Robertson said, "We are only at the start of this weather event. That's really important for people to appreciate. There is the risk, danger, and possibility of more areas being affected, so we will make sure that any changes are communicated as quickly as possible." Meanwhile, Angus Council is evacuating more than 400 homes in the red weather warning area for their own safety, with 3 rest centres set up. 2 further rest centres are being prepared in Aberdeenshire for residents unable to remain in their homes. That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday the 20th of October 2023, from the politics section. Tories lose Tamworth and Mid-Bedfordshire to Labour in by-elections. This article is written by Hamish Morrison. Labour have dealt the Conservatives a humiliating double whammy of by-election defeats by overturning huge majorities in Tamworth and Mid-Bedfordshire. Keir Starmer claimed Labour was redrawing the political map by taking seats which had been comfortably Conservative ahead of the general election expected next year. In Tamworth, Labour's Sarah Edwards defeated Tory Andrew Cooper by a majority of 1,316. The Conservatives were defending a 19,634 majority, but a 23.9 percentage point swing to Labour saw that eradicated. The result, announced shortly at 2:45 a.m, was the second highest ever by-election swing to Labour. Half an hour later, Mid-Bedfordshire recorded the largest majority overturned by Labour at a by-election since 1945. The Tories have held Mid-Bedfordshire since 1931, with a 24,664 Conservative majority in 2019. But Alistair Strathern took the seat with a majority of 1,192 over his Tory rival Festus Akinsboy, with a swing of 20.5 percentage points to Labour. Starmer said, "These are phenomenal results that show Labour is back in the service of working people and redrawing the political map. Winning in these Tory strongholds shows that people overwhelmingly want change and they're ready to put their faith in our changed Labour Party to deliver it." Voters across Mid-Bedfordshire, Tamworth and Britain want a Labour government determined to deliver for working people with a proper plan to rebuild our country. To those who have given us their trust and those considering doing so, Labour will spend every day acting in your interests and focused on your priorities. Labour will give Britain its future back. Strathern, who replaces former Minister Nadine Dorries, said his victory showed nowhere is off limits for this Labour Party, while Edwards, who replaces the disgraced Chris Pincher, challenged the Prime Minister to call a general election. "My message to the Prime Minister is to get in your government car, drive to Buckingham Palace, do the decent thing and call a general election," she said. Both contests were triggered by the high-profile departures of their previous MPs. Dorries quit, eventually, as Mid-Bedfordshire's MP in anger at being denied a peerage in Boris Johnson's resignation honours list. In Tamworth, Pincher resigned after being found to have drunkenly groped two men in an egregious case of sexual misconduct at London's exclusive Carlton Club last year, an incident which helped trigger Johnson's exit from Number 10 because of his handling of the situation. The Conservatives sought to portray the by-elections as mid-term blips exacerbated by the difficulties surrounding the previous MPs. But elections expert Professor John Curtis said the two results were extremely bad news for the Conservatives and suggested Sunak was on course for general election defeat. "This isn't destiny, but it is a pointer, and it is a pointer that, unless the Conservatives can fairly dramatically and fairly radically turn things around, then they are, in truth, staring defeat in the face in 12 months' time," he said. He warned the Tories risk seeing votes drift to Labour on the left and Reform UK on the right. Reform secured 1,487 votes in Mid-Bedfordshire and 1,373 in Tamworth, in both instances more than Labour's majority over the Conservatives. Professor Curtis told the BBC, "No government has hitherto lost to the principal opposition party in a by-election a seat as safe as Tamworth." He added that the Tories may get caught in a pincer movement between some of their former Leave voters wandering off to Labour, but others going off to Reform UK. The Tamworth result echoes Labour's victory in a by-election in its predecessor constituency, South East Staffordshire, in 1996. The Conservatives went into that contest defending a large majority, only to see Labour win the seat on a swing of 22.1 percent points before a general election landslide the following year, a result Starmer would relish repeating. Tory Cabinet Minister Robert Buckland said Sunak's party now needed to focus on the issues that mattered most to voters, rather than infighting about who could succeed the party leader. He told the BBC, "I think that as Conservatives, we now need to make it very clear what the next 5 years is going to look like, and that's what I'm looking for in the Prime Minister and our leaders. I'm not looking for academic arguments about issues that are not going to swing voters. I'm looking for serious, grown-up approaches to the issues that really matter, on the economy, on housing, on the future for our young people. We've got some good Conservative answers to these issues. Let's hear them, and let's hear nothing else in the next 12 months. Sunak was out of the country as the by-election results came in, spending the night in Saudi Arabia on a tour of the Middle East in the aftermath of the Hamas attacks on Israel. The results were announced a year to the day after Sunak's predecessor Liz Truss resigned as Prime Minister, and leaves him with a headache as he ends his first 12 months in post. In Mid-Bedfordshire, the Liberal Democrats came third and claimed their ability to switch Tory voters cleared the way for Labour's victory. Lib Dem deputy leader Daisy Cooper said, "We nearly doubled our share of the vote, which would see the Lib Dems win dozens of seats off the Conservatives in a general election." The Liberal Democrats played a crucial role in defeating the Conservatives in mid-Bedfordshire, and we can play a crucial role in getting rid of this Conservative government at the next election. That article was written by Hamish Morrison.
This is from The National on Monday, 23rd October 2023. From the News section. DWP £300 cost of living payment dates, are you eligible? By Joshua Searle. Millions of households in receipt of universal credit and other benefits will receive a £300 cost of living payment from the Department for Work and Pensions next week. The DWP announced earlier this year that the next cost of living payment would be sent to eligible households from October 31st. It is the second of three payments totalling £900 for those eligible and on means-tested benefits such as universal credit, pension credit or tax credits in 2023-24. People eligible for payments who are claiming tax credits only, who do not qualify for a payment from the DWP, will get £300 from HM Revenue and Customs between November 10th and 19th. Payments are tax-free, will not count towards the benefit cap, and will not have any impact on existing benefit awards, the UK government said. To be eligible for the latest cost of living payment from the DWP, someone needs to have been entitled to a payment for a qualifying benefit between August 18th and September 17th, or a payment for an assessment period ending between those dates. From HMRC, they need to have received a payment of tax credits for any day between August 18th and September 17th. There are several benefits that could make claimants eligible for the cost of living payment, including universal credit and tax credits, through which 5.4 million households across the UK are expected to qualify, and pension credit, through which 1.4 million pensioner households are expected to be paid. 1.3 million will be eligible through legacy DWP benefits such as Job Seekers Allowance and Income Support, reaching a total of 8.1 million households. Eligible individuals do not need to apply for payments, as they are made automatically. Those eligible for cost of living payments through tax credits and no other means-tested benefits will be paid by HMRC shortly after DWP payments are made. The exact payment dates are yet to be announced by the DWP, but this is when to expect each individual payment over the next year. Second cost of living payment, £300, October 31st to November 19th. Pensioner payment, £300, winter 2023. Third cost of living payment, £299, spring 2024. That article was by Joshua Searle. This is from The National on Monday, 23rd October 2023, from the Politics section. GB News broke broadcast rules with Martin Dobney interview, Ofcom fines. By Hamish Morrison. GB News breached impartiality rules during a programme presented by former Brexit Party MEP Martin Dobney, who was standing in for Lawrence Fox, the broadcasting watchdog has found. During the broadcast on June 16th, Dobney gave his views on immigration and asylum policy in the context of the controversy over small boats crossing the English Channel, and also interviewed Richard Tice, the leader of the Reform Party, which was formerly known as the Brexit Party. On Monday, UK media regulator Ofcom said the programme did not meet the heightened impartiality requirements, which apply to programmes discussing matters of major political controversy and current public policy. It said Tice presented his views on the programme with insufficient challenge, and the limited alternative views presented in the programme were dismissed. The programme, therefore, did not include and give due weight to an appropriately wide range of significant views, as required by the code, Ofcom said. GB News accepted that the content was not compliant with the heightened special impartiality requirements in the code. It added, "We expect GB News to take careful account of this decision in its compliance of future programming." Daubney, who was also later deputy leader of the Reclaim Party, was standing in for presenter Fox, who has since been dismissed following comments he made on air about a female journalist. The actor-turned-politician made a series of personal remarks about political correspondent Ava Evans, including asking who would want to shag that on the Dan Wootten Tonight programme on September 26th. Fox was sacked by GB News while an internal investigation into Wootten continues. That article was by Hamish Morrison. This is from The National on Monday, 23rd October 2023. From the News section. Israel strikes sites across Gaza as world leaders meet. By Gregor Young. Israeli warplanes have struck targets across Gaza, including in areas where Palestinian civilians have been told to seek refuge after another small aid shipment was allowed into the Hamas-ruled territory. Israel is widely expected to launch a ground offensive in Gaza, and it says it has stepped up airstrikes in order to reduce the risk to troops in the next stages. Fears of a widening war have escalated as Israeli planes struck targets in the occupied West Bank, Syria and Lebanon in recent days. It comes as world leaders, including Rishi Sunak and Joe Biden, along with the leaders of France, Germany, Italy and Canada, called on Israel to respect international humanitarian law and demanded the release of hostages held by Hamas and pushed for aid for Gaza. A Downing Street spokeswoman said, "The leaders reiterated their support for Israel and its right to defend itself against terrorism and called for adherence to international humanitarian law, including the protection of civilians. They welcomed the release of two hostages and called for the immediate release of all remaining hostages." The first aid convoys reached Gaza through the border with Egypt over the weekend, with 20 trucks on Saturday and a further 14 on Sunday. However, the UN said much more was needed, and the Rafah border crossing is still not open for foreign nationals seeking to flee. The number 10 spokeswoman said the leaders committed to close coordination to support their nationals in the region, in particular those wishing to leave Gaza. The leaders welcomed the announcement of the first humanitarian convoys to reach Palestinians in Gaza and committed to continue coordinating with partners in the region to ensure sustained and safe access to food, water, medical care and other assistance required to meet humanitarian needs. The leaders committed to continue close diplomatic coordination, including with key partners in the region, to prevent the conflict from spreading, preserve stability in the Middle East, and work toward a political solution and durable peace. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told troops in northern Israel on Sunday that if Hezbollah launches a war, it will make the mistake of its life. He added, "We will cripple it with a force it cannot even imagine, and the consequences for it and the Lebanese state will be devastating." Relief workers said far more aid was needed to address the spiralling humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where 2.3 million people have fled their homes. The UN Humanitarian Agency said the 20 trucks that entered on Saturday amounted to 4% of an average day's imports before the war, and a fraction of what is needed after 13 days of complete siege. The Israeli military said the humanitarian situation was under control, even as the UN called for 100 trucks a day to enter. Israel has not allowed any fuel to enter Gaza, where there has been a full power blackout for more than a week, and where hospitals say they are scrounging for generator fuel in order to keep operating life-saving medical equipment and incubators for premature babies. The World Health Organization said 7 hospitals in northern Gaza have been forced to shut down due to damage from strikes, lack of power and supplies, or Israeli evacuation orders. The lack of fuel has also crippled water and sanitation systems. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians sheltering in UN-run schools and tent camps are running low on food and are drinking dirty water. Israel repeated its calls for people to leave northern Gaza, including by dropping leaflets from the air. It estimated 700,000 have already fled, but hundreds of thousands remain. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Israel can't go back to the status quo in which Hamas controls Gaza and is able to threaten it, but that Israel has absolutely no intent to govern Gaza itself. Something needs to be found that ensures Hamas can't do this again. But that also doesn't revert to Israeli governance of Gaza, he told NBC on Sunday. It's something that needs to be worked even as Israel is dealing with the current threat. That article was by Gregor Young.
From The National, Monday the 23rd of October, from the comment section, a shift is needed to transform a predatory Westminster. Article by Kirsty Strickland. Having one MP accused of misconduct during a parliamentary term might be considered bad luck. A parliament that has shown itself to be stuffed full of sexual predators, bullies and cheats is indicative of something far more pervasive. The overrepresentation of deviants and dodgy characters of Westminster is a damning indictment on the toxic culture of our politics, and it exposes the apparent tolerance political parties seem to have for bad behaviour. The problem has got so bad that Mastermind could curate a specialist subject around the topic of MPs who were suspended, forced to resign or were subject to standards investigation since 2019, and they'd found they weren't short of material to work with. Last week, Parliament's Behaviour Watchdog published its findings into accusations against Conservative MP Peter Bowen. Its investigation upheld 5 accusations of bullying against a former male staffer and found that Bowen broke sexual misconduct rules by exposing himself to the same man while on an overseas trip. Since the report was published, Bowen has had the Conservative whip withdrawn, meaning he will now sit as an independent MP. He denied the allegations throughout the lengthy process and appealed its findings. His appeal was dismissed and, after the watchdog released its final report last week, Bowen said the allegations were false and untrue. The report recommended that the Wellingborough MP be suspended from Parliament for a period of 6 weeks. If approved by the House of Commons, that suspension would trigger a recall petition in Bowen's constituency, which could result in yet another by-election. Much has been made of the fact that the behaviour described in the report happened 10 years ago, as though a protracted period of time where a bully goes unpunished is somehow a valid argument in his defence. But the fault for the investigation taking so long to conclude lies squarely with the Conservative Party and its conveniently slow process for dealing with complaints, not the victim. A 2017 complaint to then Prime Minister Theresa May went unresolved, necessitating a 2021 complaint to the Standards Watchdog and a subsequent 2022 investigation. The Independent Expert Panel, IEP, described Bowen's behaviour as a serious case of misconduct. The report says the bullying involved violence, shouting and swearing, mocking, belittling and humiliating behaviour and ostracism. It is worth reading the report in full. It raises serious questions about the Conservative Party's handling of this case and its failure to investigate allegations in a timely manner. Some of the details are harrowing, and, despite the furious denials and claims from Bowen that the process was flawed, it is worth remembering that IEP said it found the complainers' evidence to be credible, nuanced and plausible. That evidence shows Bowen repeatedly physically struck and threw things at the former Westminster staffer. He hit him with his hand as well as various objects. It also found he repeatedly pressurised the staffer to give him a massage in the office. The incident of indecent exposure happened during a work trip to Madrid, where Bowen had taken the unusual decision to book one hotel room for himself and the complainant. When the complainant separated the twin beds, Bowen became angry and, shortly afterwards, engineered a situation where the complainant was confronted by his penis at very close quarters. The puerile jokes about this particular incident that we've seen on social media since the report was published would have only compounded the distress of the former staffer who endured it. The report says there has been a long-lasting negative impact on his life, and he has suffered continuing anxiety as a result of the way he was treated. Not only did he give up his job working for Bowen, he left politics entirely. The report rightly speaks about the abuse of power perpetrated by Bowen against his former staffer. That imbalance of power underpins so many of the incidents of bullying and sexual misconduct we see at Westminster. Reforms to the complaints process were a welcome step in making it easier for victims to come forward. But there also needs to be a real focus on the culture that makes MPs feel they can mistreat junior colleagues and staffers with impunity. Workplace practices in Westminster should be designed to ensure the safety and dignity of staff. They shouldn't be a glorified clean-up operation. It shouldn't take years for complaints to be investigated by political parties or standards watchdogs. Too often, people feel like they are left with no option but to leave Westminster. They remove themselves from a toxic situation while the perpetrators remain where they are, a place where they have considerable power and influence. Until that fundamental power imbalance is addressed, real change isn't possible. And that was a comment piece by Kirsty Strickland. From The National, Tuesday the 24th of October, from the culture section, Paul Weller announces Edinburgh Castle concert for summer 2024. Article by Lucy Garcia. A legendary rocker is set to play Edinburgh Castle next summer. Paul Weller, known as the Mod Father for his string of hits with the Jam throughout the 1970s and 1980s, announced a gig on his social media on Tuesday. Weller also found success with the Style Council in the 1980s before launching a solo career in the 1990s. He is set to play Edinburgh Castle on Saturday, July 13th, 2024. On Instagram, Weller's team wrote, "Edinburgh Castle, Paul is heading your way." We're very excited to reveal that Paul is heading back to Edinburgh Castle to perform on the 13th of July, 2024. Pre-sale tickets will be available from Wednesday the 25th of October, 9am BST. General on-sale tickets will be available from Friday the 27th of October, 9am BST. Weller previously played a show at Edinburgh Castle in July 2019. The Going Underground singer played a European tour in September, performing in Spain, France, Italy, Austria and Germany. He's also set to play gigs in Japan and Australia in 2024. And that article was by Lucy Garcia. From The National, Tuesday the 24th of October, from the culture section, skeletons found in an incredibly rare tomb unearthed on Scottish Island. Article by Steph Braun. Skeletons of men, women and children have been unearthed after archaeologists discovered the ruins of a 5,000-year-old tomb in Orkney. The incredibly rare find at the Neolithic site in Home, East Mainland, was uncovered by experts from National Museum Scotland and Cardiff University. The site was largely destroyed by Victorian antiquarians 127 years ago, but, despite the damage, 14 skeletons have been found alongside individual pieces of human bone. Local volunteers working with the University of Central Lancashire made other finds, including pottery, stone tools and a pin carved from bone. Dr. Hugo Anderson Wymark, who led the excavation, said, "Orkney is exceptionally rich in archaeology, but we never expected to find a tomb of this size in such a small-scale excavation. It's incredible to think this once impressive monument was nearly lost without record, but fortunately just enough stonework has survived for us to be able to understand the size, form and construction of this tomb." The three-week dig, which was also headed up by Professor Vicky Cummings of Cardiff University, revealed traces of a stone cairn 15 metres in diameter which contained a 7-metre long passage. The archaeologist said a stone chamber lay at the centre of the cairn, and this was surrounded by 6 smaller cells. It is believed to be a type of tomb only previously recorded 12 other times in Orkney. Professor Cummings added, "The preservation of so many human remains as one part of the monument is amazing, especially since the stone has been mostly robbed for building material. It is incredibly rare to find these tomb deposits, even in well-preserved chamber tombs, and these remains will enable new insights into all aspects of these people's lives." And that article was by Steph Braun.
From The National, on Tuesday the 24th of October 2023, from the politics section. Profoundly undemocratic, Westminster objects to Republican protest. This article was written by Lucy Jackson. A campaign group has accused the Metropolitan Police and Houses of Parliament of suppressing peaceful protest after objecting to a planned protest set to take place during the state opening of Parliament. Anti-monarchy campaign group Republic said emails from Westminster City Council show 3 objections were submitted against a peaceful protest against the monarchy by the Met Police, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Graham Smith, CEO of Republic, called the objections nonsensical and profoundly undemocratic, and expressed concern that legitimate protest is being kept away from the state opening on November 7th. He added, "These objections are a clear attempt to suppress and diminish the right to protest." An objection from the Met Police stated that the planned protest would prevent access to the area where the state opening of Parliament is due to take place, adding that the area must be kept clear of pedestrians and vehicles due to the security measurements required to safely deliver the event. The House of Lords objects to the protest as the decibel level will disturb the state opening of Parliament and noise will carry into the building and may distress the horses. The House of Commons objected to the protest as the House of Commons will be sitting and this would cause significant disruption to the business of the House. Smith responded to the objections by saying they threaten the right to peaceful protest. He said, "The objections from Parliament are nonsensical and profoundly undemocratic. They fly in the face of democratic principles and the fundamental right to peacefully protest. I have written to Parliament and the police, expressing my concern that legitimate protest is being kept away from Parliament." In a letter to the Speaker of the House of Commons, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, Smith called the objection a poor reflection on the state of our democracy. Smith wrote, "Were such objections allowed to prevail, it would mean that citizens could only protest against Parliament when Parliament was empty of MPs and not engaged in the very business about which people wish to protest. It is also clear how a protest on the other side of the road could possibly cause significant disruption to what is happening inside the parliamentary estate. Will you hear the protest? Probably. But making ourselves heard by those in power is the whole point of protest, and the right to protest explicitly protests meaningful protest. In other words, protest is held at a time and location that will allow the protest to have a meaningful impact. As the arrangements stand, our Parliament will be opened in the Chamber of Unelected Lords by an unelected monarch, while the public are kept at a considerable distance from the buildings and the proceedings. It is a poor reflection on the state of our democracy that is compounded by your objections to peaceful protest. In a letter to the Speaker of the House of Lords, John McFall, Smith questioned the reasoning behind the Lords' objection, based on the impact of protest on horses, arguing that it was a matter for police rather than Parliament. Smith wrote, "The horses in question are trained to deal with various noises and disturbances. Other parts of the route are not subjected to noise restrictions, and the experience of protest is that the horses are not caused alarm." Republic confirmed the protest will go ahead, but has been moved to the pavement on the corner of Parliament Street near Westminster Station. The campaign group has also written to Westminster City Council and Greater London Authority to seek assistance in resolving the issue. That article was written by Lucy Jackson.
The National News, on Wednesday, the 25th of October. Body found in search for missing Highlands Hill walker. An article written by James Walker. The body of a man has been found in the Highlands in the search for a missing hill walker, police have said. While formal identification is yet to take place, the family of Charles Kelly, who was 56, have been informed after police found the body in the Glenetive area of Glencoe. Police said that there are no suspicious circumstances and the report will be submitted to the Procurator Fiscal. Mr Kelly, from Tillicoutry in Clackmannanshire, went to Glencoe alone on September the 6th and was in contact with his partner the following day. He was reported missing 2 days later on September the 8th and a search was launched by the Royal Air Force. Mr Kelly, a forensic psychologist in the Scottish Prison Service with 3 adult children and a long-term partner, was said by his family to be an experienced walker who hiked in the Scottish mountains every weekend for most of his adult life. In an appeal last month, his family said he loved hill walking and nature. An article written by James Walker. The National Politics. On Wednesday, the 25th of October. Busiest Scottish car ferry route delayed again amid repairs. An article written by Xander Elliott. Kate Forbes, MSP, has said locals should be given discounted fares on a trouble-hit ferry route once service resumes. The MSP and former SNP Cabinet Secretary hit out at decades of poor forward planning by Highland Council after the local authority announced new disruption on the Corran to Ardgour route. The short crossing usually takes just 5 minutes and runs 7 days a week. However, it has been suspended since October 2022 due to essential repairs to the MV Corran. The replacement MV Maid of Glencoole, meant to serve as a backup, broke down in mid-August. As a result, there is no car ferry on a route which usually carries more than 270,000 vehicles each year. Drivers have been left with a 42-mile detour, but pedestrians have been able to cross. Highland Council had been expecting the MV Corran to be given the green light to return to service on October the 23rd. However, on Tuesday, the authority announced that it would need more time. Highland Council said in a statement, "The Marine and Coast Guard Agency inspected the MV Corran yesterday afternoon and unfortunately could not issue the passenger carrying certificate required to resume service. This was due to a bilge suction issue and this issue has since been rectified. A re-inspection by the surveyors will take place on Wednesday the 25th or Thursday the 26th of October, which is the earliest date the surveyor can be on site, Storm Babette having also affected survey work." Councillor Ken Gowans, the chair of the Council's Economy and Infrastructure Committee, said, "It's deeply disappointing that there is further delay to the return of MV Corran due to the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency inspection identifying an issue with the bilge suction that required repair. The repair has been rectified and the Council is working with the agency to arrange a re-inspection as soon as possible. At the time of writing, and subject to the vessel successfully being issued her passenger carrying certificate, the MV Coron is now expected to resume service as soon as possible during the week commencing Monday, the 30th of October. I'd like to thank the council staff for their diligence and hard work throughout this challenging period. Public safety remains our primary concern, and the crew will continue to prepare the MV Coron for re-inspection. Ms Forbes, the MSP for Skye, Lochaber and Badenoch, hit out at the news. She wrote on social media, "The latest twist in a saga that has lasted far, far too long. A fragile community is paying the price for decades of poor forward planning by Highland Council. It's time for specific support for residents and businesses, such as discounted fares, when the service resumes." Highland Council's website describes the Coron Ferry as a lifeline connection linking the communities of Fort William, Ardgour, Sunert, Ardnamurchan, Moidart, Morar, Morven and the Isle of Mull. An article written by Xander Elliots. The National News on Wednesday, the 25th of October. Endometriosis campaign could be game-changing. An exclusive article written by Steph Braun. A nationwide campaign to raise awareness of endometriosis and speed up recognition could be game-changing if the Scottish Government funds it properly, a leading charity has said. A resolution was unanimously passed at the SNP conference last week, calling on the Scottish Government to launch a nationwide awareness campaign aimed at promoting early recognition of symptoms. It also called for ministers to work with healthcare professionals to develop guidelines for diagnosis and treatment, ensuring standardised care across the country. Endometriosis is a disease where tissue similar to the womb's lining grows in other parts of the body, such as the ovaries or fallopian tubes. If left untreated, it progresses over time, so being undiagnosed can cause further damage to the bladder, bowel and other pelvic organs. Emma Cox, CEO of Endometriosis UK, said she was delighted to see such a comprehensive commitment to improving awareness and knowledge of the debilitating condition. She added that if the government funds a campaign properly, something she said she had not seen from a government in the UK before, it could spark a real step change in normalising endometriosis across society. Ms Cox told The National, "I think it's really great to see a political party taking endometriosis seriously, and we've seen that come out in practice as well in the Women's Health Plan in Scotland. What is good is it's not one simple thing, but there's a whole bunch of things that need to happen in terms of educating the public, healthcare practitioners and employers so that people can be diagnosed early, so that is a big step forward. I think the thing for me is putting it all into practice, and we're starting to see that in Scotland, but there's a long way to go. If the Scottish Government does it and funds it properly, it will be really good to see a government put genuine money and effort into doing it properly to raise awareness." Asked if the campaign could be game-changing, she added, "Yes, I think it would make a real difference. We would love to work with them on it. It would start to normalise the conversation around this so that people are seeking help and getting the help they need when they need it." The motion was put forward by Stacey Devine, an SNP councillor who suffered crippling symptoms of endometriosis for years and eventually had to undergo a hysterectomy. Her story is far from unusual. The charity said a lot of women have to wait around 8 years for a diagnosis, and it tends to be a postcode lottery when it comes to effective treatment, including in Scotland. A survey the charity undertook recently showed well over a third of people asked had either never heard of endometriosis or didn't know what it was. Ms Cox said as well as a nationwide awareness campaign, she would like to see the Scottish Government bring other building blocks into improving care for women with the condition. She added, "It needs to go hand in hand with ensuring that healthcare practitioners have the knowledge and skills to deal with people who come to them, because if we raise awareness and then people are just told to go on the pill, then there's an issue there. And rather than a one-off campaign, let's embed menstrual education throughout schools so that in the future everyone knows it right from the beginning." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, We're committed to ensuring those living with endometriosis are able to access the best possible care and support. And that is why one of the initial priorities of the Women's Health Plan is to improve access for women to appropriate support, diagnosis, and the best treatment for endometriosis. We're working intensively with NHS boards to reduce the length of time people are waiting for appointments and treatment. That is why we're investing £1 billion through the NHS Recovery Plan to support sustainable improvements and new models of care, such as our National Treatment Centre programme. An exclusive article written by Steph Braun. The National, World Politics, on Wednesday, the 25th of October. Iceland's Prime Minister joins women's strike over gender pay gap. An article written by Abby Garten-Crosby. Iceland's Prime Minister and tens of thousands of women across the nation have gone on strike for the first time in almost half a century, calling for pay equality and an end to gender-based violence. Women and non-binary people stopped both paid and unpaid work on Tuesday, the first full day of action since 1975. Katrin Jakobsdottir said she would stay home as part of the Women's Day off and expected other women in her cabinet to do the same. Confirmed participants include workers from the fishing industry, teachers, nurses and politicians, bringing the country to a standstill in a bid to draw attention to the country's ongoing gender pay gap and widespread gender-based and sexual violence. We have not yet reached our goals of full gender equality, and we're still tackling the gender-based wage gap, which is unacceptable in 2023, Ms. Jakobsdottir said. We're still tackling gender-based violence, which has been a priority for my government to tackle. Organisers have called on women and non-binary people to refuse both paid and unpaid work, including household chores, during the one-day strike. Schools and the health system, which have female-dominated workforce, said they would be heavily affected by the walkout. And national broadcaster RUV said it was reducing television and radio broadcasts for the day. Strike organisers say jobs traditionally associated with women continue to be underpaid and undervalued, such as cleaning and caregiving. We're talked about. Iceland is talked about. It's like an equality paradise, said Freya Steingrimsdottir, Communications Director for the Icelandic Federation for Public Workers and one of the strike organisers. But an equality paradise should not have a 21% wage gap and 40% of women experiencing gender-based or sexual violence in their lifetime. That's not what women around the world are striving for. With its global reputation for equality, Ms. Steingrimsdottir said Iceland has a responsibility to make sure we live up to those expectations. The walkout is being billed as the biggest since Iceland's first such event on October the 24th, 1975, when 90% of women refused to work, clean or look after children to voice anger at discrimination in the workplace. The following year, Iceland passed a law guaranteeing equal rights irrespective of gender. The original strike inspired similar protests in other countries, including Poland, where women boycotted jobs and classes in 2016 to protest against a proposed abortion ban. Iceland, an island of some 340,000 people just below the Arctic Circle, has been ranked as the world's most gender-equal country 14 years in a row by the World Economic Forum, which measures pay, education, healthcare and other factors. No country has achieved full equality and there remains a gender pay gap in Iceland. An article written by Abby Garten-Crosby. The National, on Wednesday, the 25th of October. Opinion. An increase in destitution is the legacy of Tory rule. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The cruel reality of Conservative rule Britain has been revealed in a report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which has found that 3.8 million people, including 1 million children, in the UK experienced destitution in the past year. Destitution is defined as being unable to meet essential food, clothing, energy and hygiene costs to remain warm, dry, clean and fed. There is now an epidemic of destitution in the UK, whose rulers still like to boast, possesses one of the wealthiest economies in the world. In a rich country, the proliferation of destitution is not merely an unfortunate accident. It's not a product of feckless people making wrong choices, as many on the right would have us believe. In a wealthy and developed economy, soaring levels of destitution are a product of deliberate policy choices, choices made by the Westminster government, which has control of macroeconomic policy decisions. What we're now seeing are the consequences of decades of Conservative rule, which has consistently acted on the carrot and stick principle in order to promote economic growth and active participation in the economy. But it's only the rich who get the carrots. The poor and low-paid are ruthlessly beaten with the stick. Half of the affected households were left struggling to survive on less than £85 per week after housing costs. One quarter of households affected by destitution reported having no income at all. Many of these will have become victims of sanctions in the punitive, deliberately cruel and often capricious benefit system, which is a lasting legacy of the Conservatives and a totem of their shameful rule. It's a system which the Labour Party will not improve in any meaningful way. A commitment to performative cruelty at the expense of the poor has become entrenched in both the main parties of British nationalism. In a compassionate society which valued human life, there would be universal outrage at the news that almost 4 million citizens had been reduced to destitution by a government which at the same time has presided over record profits for large companies and soaring executive pay. The average pay of company bosses is now 118 times that of the average UK worker, compared with 108 times in 2021 and 79 times in 2020, according to research from the High Pay Centre. Even now, Rishi Sunak is reportedly considering a tax cut for the 5 million highest earners, reducing stamp duty and cutting inheritance tax in an attempt to ease the pressure on his leadership after recent by-election defeats. Clearly, he hopes that this will avert the looming threat of electoral annihilation, which the Tories are deservedly facing at the next general election. In the UK, there is no money to keep 1 million children out of destitution, but money can always be found to give more cash to those who are already wealthy. Although rates of destitution are rising everywhere in the UK over the period 2019 to 2022, the study from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation reported that Scotland had by far the lowest rise in the number of people suffering from destitution. The report found Scotland's position had improved with respect to other areas of the UK, with by far the lowest increase since 2019. The report noted, "This may be indicative of the growing divergence in welfare benefits policies in Scotland, notably the introduction of the Scottish Child Payment." The report calls on the UK government to introduce an essentials guarantee into universal credit payments in order to ensure that the basic amount people receive can cover all basic needs, such as food, energy, toiletries and cleaning products. Doing this would have a significant impact on destitution. However, we know this isn't going to happen. The Conservatives are quite content to implement economic policies which foster growing destitution while benefiting the better off, because they know that destitute people don't tend to vote Tory. Rishi Sunak has rejected arguments made in the House of Commons by SNP Westminster leader Stephen Flynn that the Israeli government is perpetrating war crimes with its collective punishment of the entire population of Gaza, in retaliation for the attacks carried out by Hamas on Israeli civilians, actions which are in breach of the Geneva Convention. The death toll in Gaza is now approaching 5,800, over 2,350 of whom are children, according to the Health Ministry in the territory, and will continue to rise even higher as the bombardment and blockade of one of the most densely populated territories in the world continues. The people have nowhere to go. Israel has called on Palestinians to evacuate the northern parts of the Gaza Strip and to move further south towards the Egyptian border, but there are confirmed reports of Israeli attacks on civilian targets in the south of Gaza. Israel denies that it targets civilians, but it clearly does not trouble itself too much if civilians get in its way. Meanwhile, the British government has rejected calls for the UK to provide shelter to innocent Palestinians fleeing the conflict. Financial Secretary to the Treasury, Victoria Atkins, suggested the UK government's priority should be to keep the pressure on Hamas rather than open up a humanitarian route for Palestinian refugees to reach the UK. Her remarks came after a number of organisations devised a list of measures they said the government could implement, similar to those offered to Ukrainians, including an emergency family reunion scheme and an emergency refugee protection visa for Israelis and Palestinians fleeing the violence. The Refugee Council, Safe Passage International and Doctors of the World are among the charities which made the recommendations to the UK government. The British government, big on macho posturing, but absent when it comes to compassion, empathy and humanity. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The National Politics. On Wednesday, the 25th of October. Rishi Sunak's worst moments as he marks 1 year as Prime Minister. An article written by Abby Garton-Crosby. Rishi Sunak has marked a year as Prime Minister and had an endless slew of disastrous moments and policy failures during that time. From scrapping the UK's commitment to tackling climate change to failing to deal with the cost of living crisis hammering households across the UK, it's been a bumpy ride for those of us having to deal with the consequences of Tory inaction. There have also been numerous bungles from the Tory Prime Minister over his 365 days in charge. And not to forget, Mr Sunak wasn't even elected by his own party to the top job in Westminster, having taken on the job after Liz Truss was forced to quit over her disastrous mini-budget. The SNP has dubbed Mr Sunak's tenure so far as a failure, so the National has picked out a select few of his worst moments to celebrate the milestone. While Brexit got the ball rolling on the cost of living crisis and Liz Truss hammered it home with her disastrous mini-budget, Mr Sunak has made millions of families worse off, according to the SNP Westminster leader Stephen Flynn. Since Ms Truss's swift exit from number 10, households now have to deal with higher mortgage bills and rents, higher food and grocery prices, a rise in car and home insurance costs, as well as phone and internet bills, and crucial energy bill support was withdrawn, despite the energy crisis still being in full swing ahead of the winter. As Rishi Sunak marks a year of failure as Prime Minister, millions of families across Scotland are even worse off now than they were under Liz Truss because of his government's choices, Mr Flynn said. Neither the Tories nor the pro-Brexit Labour Party have the answers to the fundamental problem of UK decay and decline, because both parties are wedded to failed Westminster policies that have tanked the UK economy and sent the cost of living soaring, from Brexit to austerity cuts. Scotland's best future is independence. Independent countries like Scotland are wealthier and fairer than the UK, so the question is, why not Scotland? Only with independence can Scotland escape Westminster control, get rid of the Tories for good, and secure the powers we need to build a wealthier and fairer future in Europe. Mr Sunak and the Tories were accused of having blood on their hands and faced a fierce backlash in September after he U-turned on a number of the UK government's key climate commitments, and even some that had never existed in the first place. Meat tax, anyone? He pushed back the ban on the sale of new petrol and diesel cars from 2030 to 2035, weakened commitments to the phasing out of gas boilers, and a number of other Tory manifesto pledges. It followed the Prime Minister's push to tackle the also non-existent war on motorists, as he played to the climate sceptic hard right of the party, almost as if they are set for an absolute drubbing at the next general election. Scrapping policies seems to be a favourite ploy of Mr Sunak, and the HS2 link up to Manchester was another project sacrificed at the altar of Tory long-term decisions, as the Prime Minister tried to frame himself as the change candidate, despite his party being in power for 13 years. After days of refusing to commit to rumours in the press, Mr Sunak confirmed the decision at the Tory party conference, announcing a number of projects that would be funded in its place. The move prompted a furious backlash, even from his own party. Notably, what the Prime Minister didn't say was that a number of these projects had already been announced, and in some cases completed. Oh, and not to forget that the land ripped up to build the HS2 line will be sold off on the cheap. We wonder which Tory donors will benefit from that one. Mr Sunak has become renowned for his love of a private jet, on one occasion taking a 28-minute flight from London to Blackpool, and has shrugged off criticism of his love of lavish travel. He even took to social media to announce the scrapping of HS2, with a photograph of himself on a private jet. And while Labour accused the Prime Minister of potentially breaking the ministerial code by using an RAF plane to get from London to Aberdeenshire earlier this year, Mr Sunak has not been deterred. A millionaire Prime Minister who enjoys a heavy carbon footprint with flights galore. It's no wonder the net zero commitments were scrapped. At the Tory party conference earlier this month, Mr Sunak appeared to risk a potential contempt of court by making a dig about Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP finance probe during his keynote speech. He quipped to the event in Manchester that she wanted to go down in history as the woman who took Scotland to independence, but it now looks like she may go down for very different reasons. It's not a surprise that Mr Sunak chose his moment to take a pop at the former First Minister. In his conference speech in April, he dubbed the Scottish Parliament a devolved assembly. A respectful approach to devolution and Scottish politicians, as always, from the Tories. On those rare occasions that Mr Sunak has made a jaunt north of the border, most of which were in parts of the northeast where journalists were given very little notice of his visit, he has not made it very accommodating to the Scottish press pack. At the Scottish Tory party conference in July, he attempted to dodge questions from reporters and was accused of trying to give himself an easy ride. Before that, a visit to Aberdeenshire saw just 15 minutes allocated to journalists, 5 to broadcast and 10 to print. We haven't seen much of him after that either. Like Tory Prime Ministers before him, Mr Sunak has repeatedly ruled out granting a Section 30 order to allow Scotland to have a referendum on independence. He has made unfounded claims that the forces of separatism are in retreat and that the Union is stronger than ever. Mr Sunak also refused to set out the democratic route for Scotland to achieve independence. He must be ignoring polling that puts independence support steady, while the Union is not seen so favourably, of course. An article written by Abby Garton-Crosby.
From the National, Thursday the 26th of October. From the news section, BBC journalist crying in toilets over Israel-Gaza output. Article by Steph Braun. BBC journalists have allegedly been crying at work over the corporation's dehumanising coverage of Palestinians. Concerns were raised during meetings this week that the BBC had been too lenient in Israel, with staff left crying in toilets and taking time off work over the approach to the conflict. An email setting out fears that the BBC was treating Israeli lives as more worthy than Palestinian lives was sent to Tim Davey, the Director General. What Hamas did was atrocious and nobody is excusing its actions, but the mood from a lot of people in the building is that we aren't getting the coverage right, a source told the Times. Staff have been crying in the toilets and freelancers have been sacrificing earnings by not showing up to work because of the distress caused. In another email to Davey, Beirut-based correspondent Rami Ruhayem said that he had the gravest possible concerns about the output. Words like massacre, slaughter and atrocities have been used prominently in reference to actions by Hamas, but hardly, if at all, in reference to actions by Israel, he said. Does this not raise the question of the possible complicity of the BBC in incitement, dehumanisation and war propaganda? He claimed the BBC was frequently going easy on Israeli officials and allowing them comfortable airtime. The BBC has taken upon itself in recent years the task of fighting fake news, disinformation, hate speech and such things are trend in Western media, he said. Where is the content analysing the flood of incitement against Palestinians and tracking its impact? Journalist John Simpson earlier this week said the BBC had received an almost equal number of complaints about it being biased both towards and against Israel. People rail at the BBC because they hope they can force it to come down on their side. And when that doesn't happen, and it's not going to, they get angrier still, he wrote in the New Statesman. And that article was by Steph Braun. From the National, Thursday the 26th of October, from the news section. Man who bought gun and searched Dunblane massacre online jailed. Article by Laura Pollock. A man who bought a gun from the US on the dark web and searched the internet for the Dunblane massacre has been jailed for 5 years. James Maxwell, 28, from Leven, Fife, also ordered ammunition and searched online for when schools broke up for Christmas 2022. He appeared by video link from HMP Perth for sentencing at the High Court in Edinburgh on Thursday night following an earlier hearing at which he admitted 6 charges, including being in possession of indecent images of a child. Judge Lord Erict handed Maxwell a 9-year extended sentence comprising 5 years in prison and a further 4 years when he will be monitored after release from jail, telling him, "You are a grave risk to public safety." In September, Maxwell pleaded guilty to purchasing and attempting to acquire a prohibited weapon without permission or without holding a firearm certificate between December 1st, 2022 and January 11th, 2023. Maxwell also admitted buying and attempting to acquire and possess ammunition, as well as attempting to import the firearm from the US and bullets without lawful authority. He pleaded guilty to possessing child pornography between April the 22nd, 2022 and January the 11th, 2023, as well as possessing extreme images involving animals. During the sentencing, Judge Lord Ertrick told Maxwell, "You did a search for when the schools broke up for Christmas 2022. You also searched the Dunblane School massacre and primary schools in Glasgow." Lord Eric told the court the ammunition Maxwell had ordered would cause greater injury than the standard use ammunition and it had not been lawfully acquired in the UK. He added, "You purchased them on the dark web. You bought them from the USA and you paid for them with cryptocurrency." The court heard the firearms were intercepted before they arrived at Maxwell's address and he was subsequently arrested. Prosecutors said Maxwell's plans were thwarted after US law enforcement officers searched and found a Glock 75 handgun and ammunition in a UK-bound mail package, which included Maxwell's address and phone number and immediately alerted Police Scotland. 4 days later, a package containing the empty Glock gun box and 2 ammunition boxes was delivered to Maxwell's home, and officers arrived with a search warrant and found it in his bedroom. Eric added, 100 rounds of that kind of ammunition used would have been unimaginable. You're a grave risk to public safety. Concluding, Eric said, "I commend both the USA law officers and Police Scotland for their actions in ensuring the gun and ammunition were not received by you." Maxwell will also be placed on the Sex Offenders Register for a period of 7 years. His lawyer, Jonathan Groh, told the court in mitigation that Maxwell had a troubled upbringing and left secondary school at age 13 following the death of his father by suicide. He subsequently failed to return to any kind of education or employment, and Crow told the court Maxwell never received any support to do so. Crow said, "He spent time in his room playing games and watching DVDs, and his life has followed the same pattern ever since." A psychiatric assessment found Maxwell described himself as suicidal for many years, Crow said. It also said he had no contact with the outside world, and Maxwell lived online for many years. As a result, the psychiatric report said Maxwell developed Americanized values, common among those who spend time online, particularly around guns, which made his behaviour seem odd when compared to the norms of British society. Crowe told the court Maxwell was simply unaware of the severity of what he had done, or that gun ownership in the UK was unusual or unlawful. He added, "Locking Mr. Maxwell in a prison cell is going to do little for him, given the circumstances," and called for leniency in sentencing him. And that article was by Laura Pollock. From the National, Thursday the 26th of October, from the news section, Rachel Reeves accused of plagiarising parts of her new book by Hamish Morrison. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves' publisher has said future editions of her new book will be revised after accusations parts of the work have been plagiarised. The Labour frontbencher rejects the accusations, but the Financial Times said that it had found parts of The Woman Who Made Modern Economics had been lifted from other books, articles and from Wikipedia. At an event in Westminster on a Thursday night, Reeves admitted parts of the work had been written by research assistants who had drawn on a range of sources, including Wikipedia. Speaking at the Institute for Government, she said, "I wanted to carve out time to write this book. In acknowledgements, I acknowledge the research assistants, particularly on the facts and the detail that went into pen portraits of the women that I speak about. That came from a range of sources, from books, from interviews, from articles, from Wikipedia." Manual checks carried out by staff at the Financial Times are said to have found more than 20 instances where text is directly reproduced from elsewhere without acknowledging the original sources. One example cited by the Financial Times, which this paper has verified, appears to have lifted almost word for word from the Wikipedia article for Beatrice Webb, the co-founder of the London School of Economics. The section in the book reads, "For her part, Beatrice Webb voiced disapproval of Wells's sordid intrigue with the daughter of a veteran Fabian member. He responded by lampooning the couple in his 1911 novel, The New Machiavelli, as Altiora and Oscar Bailey, a pair of short-sighted bourgeois manipulators." The Wikipedia article reads, "For her part, Beatrice voiced disapproval of Wells' sordid intrigue with the daughter of a veteran Fabian school, Sidney Olivier. He responded by lampooning the couple in his 1911 novel, The New Machiavelli, as Altiora and Oscar Bailey, a pair of short-sighted bourgeois manipulators." A spokesperson for Reeves told The Telegraph, "These were inadvertent mistakes and will be rectified in future reprints." Reeves' publisher Basic Books said, "At no point did Rachel seek to present these facts as original research. There is an extensive and selected bibliography of over 200 books, articles and interviews. Where facts are taken from multiple sources, no author would be expected to reference each and every one. While factual sentences were taken from primary sources, they should have been rewritten and properly referenced. We acknowledge that this did not happen in every case. As always, in instances such as these, we will review all sources and ensure any omissions are rectified in future reprints." And that article was by Hamish Morrison.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.